Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and in the early hours of Friday, the 24th of November, these are our main stories. A temporary halt in the fighting between Israel and Hamas is due to begin shortly, paving the way for a hostage and prisoner exchange. War crimes prosecutors in The Hague have accused the detained former president of Kosovo, Hashim Thaçi, of tampering with witnesses. A woman has accused New York City's mayor, Eric Adams, of sexual assault 30 years ago. Also in this podcast, there's been another delay in the rescue operation to free dozens of workers trapped in a tunnel in northern India.
I was speaking with one tunneling emergency expert here who was saying just how deeply frustrating it is to get so close. And there was this hope and expectation that the men would be able to be rescued.
And the plague of rats that's overrunning parts of the Australian state of Queensland. As we record this podcast, it looks as if some of the hostages who've been held in Gaza will be released in a few hours' time as part of a deal between Israel and Hamas, which will see fighting paused for 4 days. Palestinian prisoners will be freed from Israeli prisons in exchange. Qatar, which brokered the deal, confirmed that a list of names of those being swapped has been agreed. A foreign ministry spokesman in Doha, Majid al-Ansari, said an initial group of 13 hostages held by Hamas would be released.
The first batch of civilians to be released from Gaza will be around 4 p.m. of the same day. They will be 13 in number, all women and children, and those hostages who are from the same families will be put together within the same patch. Obviously, every day will include a number of civilians, as agreed, to total 50 within the 4 days.
So, as he said, 50 hostages should be released over the next 4 days in exchange for 150 Palestinian women and teenagers. The deal had initially been expected to take effect on Thursday morning, but was delayed by a day as details were hammered out. Adem Manit, whose cousin is among the hostages being held by Hamas, welcomed the announcement by Qatar.
Obviously, really relieved that the children and some of the women hostages will be hopefully released by tomorrow morning. We were hoping it would happen this morning. I mean, you can imagine what it's like to be a parent of one of those children and waking up this morning and still none of your children being home yet. Obviously, we're continuing to hope that this leads to more hostages being released and Thaçi could come home because he has children too.
With swathes of Gaza reduced to rubble and many people struggling to get basic supplies, this Gazan woman, Ala al-Sawat, in the camps of Khan Yunis, said she hoped a truce would mean more aid coming in.
We're struggling. Every day, we say that our time to die is here today or tomorrow. When they talk of a truce, we get happy, but it gets devastating when we hear of airstrikes. We want a truce for a lifetime.
But for now, the fighting is still raging in Gaza. The medical director of the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza has said conditions are desperate as Israel continues its attacks nearby. And the director of another besieged hospital, Al-Shifa, has been arrested by Israel along with several colleagues. Our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson, told me that after many delays, it did seem as if a first group of hostages would now finally be freed.
Hopes have been dashed before, so it's still very precarious. There's this great lack of trust, and we've even had from the Israeli government a comment by one of the ministers saying he didn't trust Hamas. And also, there are several groups in Gaza who are holding hostages. It's not just Hamas, and any one of those could perhaps break this ceasefire, so it's very tenuous.
And in the meantime, fighting is continuing in Gaza, and it's particularly intense around the Indonesian hospital in the north of the territory.
It is indeed, yes. There have been tanks firing for much of the day. In fact, for several days now, this has been going on. 12 people killed on Monday in a shelling. So it's very, very difficult there. And we've been, the BBC's been speaking to the medical director, as you mentioned earlier on, and he said that the firing has been so intense that people are having to take shelter in the corridors. They can't go in the rooms because the windows have been smashed by gunfire. And the medical director said even his own office has been targeted several times. And this is all being attacked because the Israelis, like with Al-Shifa Hospital, they suspect there are tunnels underneath the hospital and that it's been used by Hamas for military purposes.
As you say, all very reminiscent of Al-Shifa. And Israel was saying that there was a Hamas command centre there. They have now apparently arrested the director of Al-Shifa and some of the medical staff there. Has Israel been able to prove that this was a Hamas command centre?
In a word, no. What they have found is weapons. They've found the tunnel system underneath. They found a very sturdy blast door there too at the entrance to the tunnels. But it hasn't been proven as a command centre. That's quite different to a few rooms and a tunnel and some weapons.
Mike Thompson, as the intensity of shelling along the border between Israel and Lebanon increases, tens of thousands of people on either side have left their homes. Israel has been accused of, quote, unlawfully targeting fleeing Lebanese civilians, including a family, three children and their grandmother who were killed by an airstrike earlier this month. Israel says it's investigating the incident. The UN, which patrols the blue line between Lebanon and Israel, also says it hopes but has no expectation that the pause in hostilities due to begin in Gaza will be replicated there. From southern Lebanon, Wera Davis reports.
So we're up on the Lebanese border with Israel, with civil defence units. All we know is that there's been an airstrike on a house and a woman has apparently been killed. Almost every day since the border conflict between Hezbollah and Israel began, emergency services have sped towards the aftermath of airstrikes and missile attacks. This one is in the village of Kfar Kela. 45 minutes ago, there was a strike on a house here in which there was a family, a mother, a father and several children. We know the mother has been killed. Father and children are in hospital. All that's left is a completely burnt out house, partially destroyed. And there's a pretty large pool of blood here on the steps. We later learned it was an elderly woman killed in the attack and a young girl was seriously injured.
In this village you can see...
The local civil defence chief, Anis Alba, says civilians have increasingly become victims of this war.
For us, the biggest concern is about the civilians. We have to save them every time.
But it's dangerous.
Yes, it's dangerous. Yes, we know. But living in Lebanon is dangerous too.
As we spoke to the fire chief, an Israeli drone cruised the skies above, over Lebanese territory, where the powerful Islamist Hezbollah organization is dominant and from where it fires rockets into Israel. The drones are used by Israel to strike what it says are Hezbollah positions.
In UNIFIL, there are 10,500 peacekeepers.
It's the United Nations job to patrol the fragile blue line between Israel and Lebanon.
Headquarters, I would say around
spokesman Andrea Tinetti says that the conflict here has escalated sporadically over the last 7 weeks.
Difficult to say because the shelling has been intense, as thousands of rockets and exchanges of fires on a regular basis. So when you have such an intensity of the conflict in a very localized area where people are living, of course, the risk of hitting and killing civilians is higher.
The Shore family knew it was too dangerous to remain in their home near the border. Shortly after leaving in a car for Beirut, the mother, grandmother and three children were hit by a strike from an Israeli drone. Their uncle Samir, in another car, survived.
Barely recognisable as a family car. Every bit of metal is twisted. It's completely burnt out. The three little girls who were sat in the back stood absolutely no chance. The grandmother in the front was killed outright. There's a bag of olives just on the floor here beside me. Charred food that they'd bought for their journey just 2 minutes down the road.
The organisation Human Rights Watch says what happened to the Shur family should be investigated as an apparent war crime. Samir visits the charred wreckage every day and shows me the school books that were in the car when it was hit.
That's all that's left. Burnt pencil cases. Everything inside the pencil case is molten.
The uncle rejects Israel's explanation that it struck a suspicious vehicle containing terrorists. The Israeli army says it's investigating claims that there may have been uninvolved civilians. The only person Samir was able to pull from the wreckage alive was the girl's mother, Hoda Hijazi.
I will always remember her screams and cries. She was telling me, "Get my kids out of the car. Get my kids out of the car." She repeated this over and over until I dragged her out.
14-year-old Rimas, Talin, who was 12, and 10-year-old Leanne only came back to the border for their school stuff. School years they will never finish, and more young lives lost in a war along one of the most volatile frontiers in the world.
That report by Wira Davis. A woman has accused New York City's mayor, Eric Adams, of sexual assault in court papers filed on Wednesday. The allegations date back to 30 years ago. Mr. Adams has denied the claims. This legal action is the latest in an avalanche of such lawsuits which have been filed over the past year in New York State under the Adult Survivors Act, which temporarily suspended the statute of limitations for civil claims brought by victims of historic sexual abuse. Our North America correspondent, Shingai Nyoka, told us more.
Eric Adams is the current mayor of New York, and before he became a politician, he was a police officer rising to the ranks of captain for about 20 years. And so it's during that time that the plaintiff, an unidentified woman, says that while they were both employed for working for the New York Police Department, that she was sexually assaulted. And so in her 3-page legal filing, she says that she was not just sexually assaulted, but she accuses him of sexual battery as well as discrimination in the workplace and emotional distress. And she's not just suing Eric Adams, she's also suing the city of New York and the police department and asking for $5 million in relief.
And this legal action is just the latest in a long series which have been filed in the past year under a special temporary law.
Yes, that's right. We understand that over 2,500 cases have been filed by individuals as well as corporately. A lot of them are targeted at the New York State Department. But what we've also seen is an increase in the number of celebrities that have been named. So over the last week or so, we've already reported, for example, on Sean Combs, who is a rapper who was accused of sexual assault spanning a 10-year period by his ex-girlfriend. Over the last 24 hours, the Guns N' Roses lead singer Axl Rose was also named, as well as Jamie Foxx. All of them so far have denied these allegations, as has Eric Adams. But interestingly, Sean Combs settled out of court with his ex-girlfriend. But there is likely to be more and more lawsuits as this deadline expires end of day today.
Because, yeah, it is about to expire, so this would be the end for this act. So you are seeing this last-minute flurry of cases.
Yes, absolutely. So after midnight Thursday, no one will be able to sue for sexual assault that took place a long time ago. And the rationale, the reason why this law was put in place, was they said that trauma takes time and there are a lot of victims that suffered trauma that hadn't yet come forward. Initially, it was meant for children, but then later extended to include adults. That's why we're seeing a lot of these cases over the last year or so where celebrities as well as the New York State Department have been named.
Shingai Enyoka. The former president of Kosovo, Hashim Thaci, is in detention in The Hague. He's accused of war crimes during the country's war of independence from Serbia in the 1990s, when he was the leader of the Kosovo Liberation Army. Now, prosecutors have called for a ban on his visits and those to two other former KLA commanders. They're also seeking to restrict phone calls and written communications and have called for the three to be segregated from other detainees. I asked our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay why.
Well, this is a response, really, to the worry that they've always had at the court, which is that there was going to be extensive witness tampering. And we've seen this before when there have been attempts at war crimes tribunals to try former senior leaders of the Kosovo Liberation Army. For example, at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, the former Prime Minister of Kosovo, Ramush Haradinaj, was tried and acquitted twice. And the reason there was a retrial in that case was exactly because of witness tampering. Now, why do we get this issue with witness tampering? Well, look at who the KLA were. For many Kosovo Albanians, they're national heroes. They were the people who obtained Kosovo's liberation from Serbia's Milosevic regime and led to the unilateral declaration of independence in 2008. And Hashim Thaci is a really key figure in all of that. So there's lots of pressure on people already for them not to testify against Hashim Thaci in this war crimes tribunal, the new specialist chambers in The Hague. And, you know, it's adding to that, if you've got witness tampering, witness interference, witness intimidation, it's very, very difficult to have a credible judicial process if you have these sort of things going on. That's why the prosecutors have made this request.
But what's the response been from Hashim Thaci's lawyers?
Well, they've said they need time to address the allegations. But in the meantime, the specialist chambers has actually agreed temporarily to the prosecution's requests. They've ordered an interim set of restrictions on the communications and visits that Hashim Thaci and two of his co-defendants can actually enjoy. And they say these restrictions are appropriate given the risk of unlawful disclosure of confidential information from the detention facilities. And the restrictions will remain temporary until the panel issues a full decision in due course. So everybody's now going to be looking at the accusations of the prosecution, including Mr. Thaci's defence lawyers, and we'll hear later on whether these restrictions will be imposed in a longer term.
Guy Delaunay. Still to come on the Global News podcast, we look at how the climate emergency is affecting motherhood.
I don't have the luxury of just feeling sad and hopeless all the time. I would have to do everything in my power to make it better for the children.
Food is incredibly important in the world.
It's about survival,
culinary heritage,
culture and tradition,
different relationships across the world.
The Food Chain from the BBC World Service examines the business, science and cultural significance of food.
If this kind of food is lost, a community will lose its identity.
On what it takes to put food on your plate.
This is an incredible journey.
Search for The Food Chain wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News podcast. Geert Wilders has been dubbed Europe's Donald Trump, partly because of his fiery attacks on immigrants and Muslims, and partly because of his dyed blonde bouffant hairdo. And now, like Mr. Trump, he's caused a political upset, with his party unexpectedly coming first in elections in the Netherlands. He insists he will be prime minister for everyone as he prepares for coalition talks to form a government, even though the other main parties have said they won't serve under him because of his far-right policies. He wants a referendum to take the Netherlands out of the European Union. Katja Adler has been looking at what his victory means for Europe and its populist parties.
Geert Wilders is well known for his anti-Muslim, anti-immigration rhetoric. His unexpectedly meaty election win saw hard-right politicians across Europe jostling to congratulate him. They believe this is their moment. Marine Le Pen of France said Mr. Wilders' success, with his pledge to return the Netherlands to the Dutch, was proof people in Europe were ready to defend national identities. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban, known like Mr. Wilders for rousing anti-migrant and Eurosceptic speeches, concluded the winds of change were blowing across the continent. But Geert Wilders doesn't have enough seats to govern alone. Weeks of political horse trading, otherwise known as coalition building, stretch ahead. He's admitted he'll have to compromise. If he does become Prime Minister, things could get uncomfortable in Brussels, though today the European Commission insisted it wasn't worried. Geert Wilders is unlikely to fulfil his dream of taking the Netherlands out of the EU. He accepts public opinion isn't behind him on that one. And he had to tone down his anti-Islam stance to climb in pre-election opinion polls. But EU unity on Ukraine is looking less strong. Mr. Wilders joins Hungary and Slovakia in opposing sending more military aid to Kyiv. And he hit the voter priority nail on the head in homing in on migration, and the cost of living crisis. And the mood in the Netherlands, as across much of Europe, is becoming more hardline.
Katja Adler. Violent protests have broken out in the Irish capital Dublin after a stabbing attack outside a school left three children and a woman injured. The attacker has not been identified, but after anti-immigrant groups said he was a foreigner, crowds gathered near the scene chanting slogans. They clashed with riot police, setting a police car on fire and damaging other vehicles. The motive for the stabbing remains unclear. From Dublin, Sarah Gevin sent this report.
Well, smoke has been seen billowing over Dublin city centre as a multiple stabbing turned into a night of violence. Three young children were stabbed close to their school in Dublin earlier this afternoon. Two of them and a woman remain in hospital being treated for their injuries. Eyewitnesses said bystanders wrestled a man to the ground and removed a knife from his hand. That man, who's in his 40s, is being described by police as a person of interest. Irish Police, the Gardaí, have said they're not looking for anyone else in relation to what happened this afternoon. And what happened then has led to hours of intense rioting. We've seen a bus on fire, a car on fire, clashes between protesters and police, and fireworks thrown at them, and front windows of shops smashed too. Now, we heard earlier from the Garda Commissioner, Drew Harris, who said the people involved should go home, he said, and let police do their job. He blamed the violence on what he described as a lunatic hooligan faction, and he appealed to them not to listen to any speculation that they might have read on social media.
Sarah Gervin. Researchers say that the climate emergency is making more women reconsider having children in areas of the developing world. The study by the UK's University of Nottingham spoke to people in 11 countries about how the threat of climate change might affect their decision to start a family. As part of the BBC 100 Women season, our environment correspondent, Navin Singh Kadka, spoke to three women from across the global south who have serious concerns about motherhood.
It's May 2022. A team of Brazilian emergency workers and local residents picked through the debris in a destroyed neighbourhood of the northeastern coastal town of Recife. Heavy rains have caused flooding and landslides, killing 120 people. Watching this disaster unfold was climate researcher Julia Borges.
I started studying climate change more deeply, and the climate issue became central in my life. But that also led to an increase in my anxiety. I started to imagine catastrophic outlooks of actual global destruction.
But it wasn't just her career or mental health that were affected, but her confidence in starting a family.
I cannot see myself as being responsible for the life of another human being or for generating a new life. That would become an extra burden to a planet that is so overloaded already.
Julia is not alone. Nottingham University researchers focused on adults in 11 countries and asked whether anxiety about climate change had made them think they should not have children or made them regret having them. In Brazil, more than half of respondents said yes. In India, it was almost 3 out of 4. Srishti Singh Shrestha from Nepal also felt that way after she gave birth to her daughter.
Once I had her, then I had this sudden pang of guilt every morning, and I looked at her face, understanding how climate change is actually changing lives for the worst, for the planet, for the animals, and for our children. With this realization, I used to cry every day. And that was when I decided, I was pretty sure that I'm not going to have another child again.
According to UNICEF, Nigeria is the second most vulnerable country worldwide in terms of children's exposure to climate change. Last year alone, historic flooding put nearly 1.5 million children in the country at risk of disease, malnutrition and drowning. Nigerian Ayomide Olude runs the Eco Anxiety Africa Project, which offers support to those whose mental health is being impacted by climate risks.
Why would I want to have children or want to bring kids into the world in a place where I'm not even sure I'll be able to protect a child?
Ayomide says she has to stand up to both societal and family pressures.
In a society where women barely have the power to decide, and where there are religious beliefs that one should have kids, it takes considerable strength and determination to say this in public.
In the face of increasing climate distress, Srishti is looking for ways to cope.
I don't have the luxury of just feeling sad and bad and feeling hopeless all the time. I would have to do everything basically in my power to bring change, whatever I can, whatever small it is, to make it better for the children.
Srishti Singh Shrestha from Nepal, ending that report from Navin Singh Katka. The operation to rescue 41 construction workers who've been trapped for days in a collapsed tunnel in northern India has once again had to be put on hold. It was paused after a new drilling machine, which had been making good progress, hit further debris just metres from the trapped men. Arnold Dix is from the International Tunnelling Association, which is helping with the rescue operations.
At the moment, it's like we're there, we're knocking.
Yeah.
We know the guys are on the other side, but we can't get in.
Our correspondent, Samira Hussain, is at the tunnel entrance. She told us more about this latest delay.
Rescue efforts have now been put on pause because they have run into yet another snag. So to give you a sense of just what they're contending with, remember this accident happened because of a landslide and it crushed a partially built tunnel. And so there were people working inside, but there was also a lot of machinery inside the tunnel when it collapsed. And so they have a drilling machine that they are using to drill through these several meters of debris. And every so often, they're met with pieces of metal. Well, that's exactly what happened again. And that piece of metal ended up breaking the drilling machine. And now those rescue operations have been put on hold yet again, and they don't expect to be up and running again until tomorrow.
That is just so frustrating. How close are they to the men?
They say they're within 12 to 18 meters. It's all an estimate. They estimate that it's the men are about 57 to 60 meters behind this wall of debris. So they are inching closer and closer. And in fact, I was speaking with one tunneling emergency expert here who was saying just how deeply frustrating it is to get so close. And there was this hope and expectation that the men would be able to be rescued by yesterday or even today. But that has now changed, of course.
What next? What's the plan?
The plan is they're going to continue as they've done in the past when they've had difficulties with their machinery. They're going to wait for replacement parts. They're going to get it fixed, and then they're going to continue on with their rescue efforts. It's important to note, though, just how complicated it is to actually get new pieces of machinery into this area. I mean, we're talking about really narrow roads, going windy roads going up a mountain. To give you a sense of just how complicated it can be, it took me 11 and a half hours to get here from the capital of New Delhi. So it's hard to get this kind of sophisticated equipment into this area.
Samira Hussain in Uttarakhand state in northern India. Parts of the state of Queensland in Australia have been overrun with a plague of rats. As Mickey Bristow reports, a wet winter and a good harvest have created the ideal breeding conditions for them.
The rats are everywhere and in massive numbers. There are so many that they've been forced to migrate across Queensland in search of food. Hordes of them have even turned up, some dead, some alive, on the beaches of coastal towns. The rats reproduce quickly and an explosion in their numbers often follows periods of prolonged rainfall in Australia. But experts say the rodents might soon run out of food and the population should then crash.
Mickey Bristow. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. And as the next UN summit on climate change approaches, we're also making a special edition of the Global News podcast looking at where the world has got to in its efforts to tackle the problem. So we want your questions, which we'll be putting to two of our science and climate experts. What would you like to know about the changing climate or about how these summits work? Do you think our leaders are responding in the right way? And what would you ask them if you were there? If you can, please send us a recording of your question along with your name and where you're from to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. We look forward to hearing from you. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley. It was mixed by Nick Randall. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.